The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Okay, welcome back, everyone. Today we're diving into something, something you probably encounter, maybe even do, every single day, often without thinking much about it.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking about ritual.
Exactly. It sounds simple, right? Yeah. A wedding, maybe a morning routine.
But the moment you try to pin it down to give it one single definition, it gets really complex really fast.
It does. And that's why we're exploring the work of Barry Stevenson today. His scholarship kind of pushes us to hold two ideas that seem like they conflict.
Right. So idea number one, ritual is absolutely fundamental for human meaning, for stability.
And then idea number two, the actual word ritual, the concept itself, it's basically a scholarly invention.
Yeah.
And a loaded one. Packed with historical bias.
It's a bit of a mind bender, but what we hope you get from this deep dive is a kind of critical toolkit. Yeah, a way to see what Stevenson calls ritualization happening all around you in places you might not expect.
Like your team meetings at work, maybe? Chance at a football game?
Or even just how you meticulously make your coffee every morning.
Uh-huh. And the goal is that once you start seeing this underlying choreography,
you can be more intentional about it, right? Instead of just going through the motions, you can understand the meaning being made or even shape it yourself.
That intentionality is absolutely central. And it comes from Stevenson's really unique perspective. He's a distinguished scholar, religious studies at Memorial University of Newfoundland.
And his focus isn't just documenting different rituals, like here's a list.
No, not at all. He's doing what he calls a meta-level analysis. Yeah. He's studying the theories about ritual. How have scholars even thought about this concept?
So he's looking at the people, looking at the rituals.
Exactly. Pulling from anthropology, sociology, performance studies. Hmm. It's very interdisciplinary.
What makes his angle so distinctive, though?
Well, I think it's that he's rigorously academic, but he avoids taking easy sides. He's not just dismissing ritual, you know, as old-fashioned superstition.
But he's not romanticizing it either, like it's some pure mystical thing.
Precisely. He actually questions the tools scholars themselves use.
Mm-hmm.
He asks if ritual is even a neutral, objective category we could just find out in the world.
Okay, so that brings us back to that core tension in his work. Let's unpack that thesis. You said it has two layers.
Yeah, so the first layer is, let's call it, the functional thesis.
Okay.
On this level, rituals are just necessary. Humans need them. They serve these crucial psychological, social, cultural functions, especially today.
How so?
Well, think about big life changes, birth, death, getting married, starting a new job. Rituals help us navigate those transitions. They give structure.
And they help build identity, create community.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In a world that feels increasingly fragmented, rituals can provide that vital social glue.
That makes intuitive sense. We need structure. We need connection. But then Stevenson introduces the second layer, the critical thesis. And this is where it gets tricky.
Right. This is the provocative part. He argues that the term ritual isn't some natural thing we discovered. It was constructed.
Instructed by who?
Primarily by scholars, often with specific, you know, Western, maybe Protestant viewpoints, and often used to categorize what other people did, people who weren't like them.
Wow. So if the word itself is biased from the start, how can we even use it? Does Stevenson want us to just ditch the term entirely?
Not exactly. And this is the key move he makes. He says we need to shift our focus.
Hmm.
Stop asking what is a ritual, like it's a fixed object.
You ask.
Ask how, why, and by whom certain actions get labeled as ritual or set apart as special. He shifts from the noun ritual to the verb ritualization.
Ritualization. Okay, so it's about the process of making something ritual-like.
Exactly. It's a strategic action. Mm. And understand that frees us from the term's problematic history while still letting us analyze the powerful ways these actions work.
That shift really makes you look at the history differently. Where did this loaded term even come from?
Well, it kind of emerged from two main streams, both of which created this bias. First, you had the post-Reformation arguments in Europe.
Protestants versus Catholics.
Yeah. Protestants often criticize Catholic practices as empty, just external shows, mere ritual. That phrase itself implies something less genuine than internal sincere belief.
So right away, ritual got linked to something potentially inauthentic.
Uh-huh. Then the second stream was the colonial period. Early anthropologists, mostly Western guys, went out studying non-Western cultures.
And they saw all these complex practices.
And lumped them together under this single broad label, privative ritual. It basically cemented this idea that ritual was something they did, something less evolved than our rational ways.
That's a pretty biased starting point for understanding anything.
Definitely. But thankfully, the thinking evolved. We moved towards functionalism, and the big name there is Emil Durkheim.
The sociologist. What was his take?
Durkheim saw rituals as incredibly powerful social tools. He wasn't focused on belief in gods, necessarily. He was interested in what happens when people do rituals together.
And what happens?
They generate what he called collective effervescence.
Collective effervescence. It sounds bubbly.
Slight chuckle.
Naida.
It's that intense shared emotional energy you feel in a crowd, like at a huge concert, a political rally, a major sporting event.
Okay, yeah, I know that feeling.
Durkheim argued that in those moments, the group isn't just feeling good together. They're essentially feeling and reinforcing the power of society itself, the group bond. So ritual creates social cohesion. It's vital technology for keeping society together.
So Durkheim explained why we need it for social glue. Who explained how it actually works structurally?
That's where Arnold van Gennep and later Victor Turner come in. They focused on rites of passage.
The ceremonies around life's big transitions.
Exactly. Van Gennep outlined this classic three-phase structure. First, separation, you leave your old status behind. Third, re-aggregation, you're officially integrated into your new status.
And the middle part.
That's liminality, the in-between stage. You're on the threshold.
Either here or there.
Right. Your old identity is gone. The new one isn't fully formed yet. It could be disorienting, even scary.
But also powerful.
Hugely powerful. And Turner really dug into this liminal phase. He identified something called communitas.
Communitas.
It's this intense feeling of bonding, of equality that happens when people are in that liminal state together, stripped of their usual social roles and hierarchies.
Like basic training in the army, or maybe those intense group retreats.
Perfect examples. That feeling of we're all in this together, overcoming hardship, forging deep bonds outside the normal rules. That's communitas.
Okay, so we have social function, individual transition. What came next?
The focus shifted towards meaning and symbols, largely thanks to the anthropologist Clifford Geertz.
Geertz, right. He saw culture as a text to be read.
Exactly. And for him, rituals weren't just actions. They were public performances, like plays or stories that dramatically enact a culture's deepest values, its core beliefs about the world.
So you can't just watch a ritual. You have to interpret it.
Right. You need what he famously called thick description.
Thick description, meaning.
Meaning you don't just describe the surface action. Someone winks, someone shouts, someone exchanges something. You have to uncover the layers and layers of cultural meaning embedded in those actions for the people doing them.
Like his analysis of the Balinese cockfight, it wasn't just about chickens fighting.
Not at all. For Geertz, it was this incredibly complex, symbolic drama about status, masculinity, risk, social networks, all played out in the betting and the fighting. The meaning was dense or thick.
Okay, so all these threads, function, transition, meaning how do they come together in the contemporary view? You mentioned Catherine Bell.
Yes, Catherine Bell's work is really pivotal for bringing this all together in a way that works for studying ritual today.
What was her key contribution?
She really cemented that shift we talked about earlier, away from asking, is this a ritual, and towards asking how things become ritualized.
The verb again.
The verb. She argued that ritualization is a strategy. It's about how certain actions are deliberately set apart from ordinary everyday actions.
How are they set apart?
Through things like formalization. Mm. Do them in a very precise, prescribed way. Mm. Repetition. Using special gestures, specific language, creating a sense of gravity or importance around them.
And this applies to anything, sacred or secular.
That's the crucial point. Bell helps dissolve that old artificial line between sacred ritual and secular ceremony. A corporate awards night can be ritualized. A protest march can be ritualized. A graduation can be ritualized. It's about how the action is performed and framed to give it power and significance.
That really opens up the possibilities for analysis. It lets us use this toolkit everywhere.
It does. And when you synthesize all these theoretical perspectives, Stevenson highlights a few really critical takeaways.
Okay, what are the big ones?
First, this idea of ritual as embodied knowledge.
Embodied knowledge, meaning knowledge in the body, not just the head.
Exactly. It pushes back against the typical Western idea that real knowing is purely intellectual, abstract thought. Ritual teaches through doing, through the senses, through muscle memory.
Like learning a dance or a martial art form, or even just the physical act of prayer or meditation.
Precisely. Your body learns and holds knowledge that your conscious mind might not even be able to articulate. He calls it somatic intelligence.
That's powerful. What's the second theme?
Ritualization is power and distinction. This connects back to Bill's idea of strategy.
Okay.
Setting an action apart as ritual is never neutral. It's always doing something socially, politically. It might be used to solidify the authority of a leader or an institution. Think of a judge wearing robes or a coronation.
Right. It marks them as special, gives them legitimacy.
Or it can be used to challenge authority. Think about symbolic acts of protest, laying down in the street, holding a vigil. These are ritualized actions designed to disrupt the status quo and assert a different kind of power.
So the act of ritualizing itself draws lines, creates insiders and outsiders, reinforces or contests power structure.
Always. And the third main takeaway is the adaptive force of ritual.
Meaning rituals aren't stuck in the past.
Not at all. Despite predictions that modernity and secularization would kill off ritual, they haven't. Rituals are incredibly dynamic. They change. They adapt.
So new rituals emerge. Old ones change shape.
Constantly. Think about how weddings have changed, or how new online communities develop their own ritualized ways of interacting. Healthy traditions adapt to new technologies, new social norms, while still providing those core functions of meaning, transition, and community.
They just might not look like the old stained glass window version of ritual.
Exactly. They relocate, they reconfigure, but the underlying human need and the strategies of ritualization persist.
Stevenson really captures some of these big ideas in memorable ways, doesn't he? You mentioned some key quotes or statements.
He does. They really make you stop and think. For instance, this one. Ritual is the body's way of knowing what the mind cannot grasp.
Yeah, that hits on the embodied knowledge point. It suggests there's a wisdom in disciplined action, in physical practice, that thinking alone can't reach. Like, maybe the insights from years of meditation aren't concepts, but a changed state of being.
Precisely. Or consider this one. We do not have rituals. Rituals have us.
That flips the script. It suggests ritual isn't just a tool we pick up and use.
Right. It suggests that deep participation in ritual requires a kind of surrender. It changes you. It shapes your identity, your perception. You don't just perform the ritual. The ritual performs you, in a sense.
That makes participation sound much more significant, more transformative.
It is. And finally, maybe the most relevant for our times. In a world of constant change, ritual provides the stability of repetition. In a world of alienation, ritual creates the intimacy of shared experience.
That really nails why it persists, doesn't it? In all the chaos and disconnection of modern life, ritual offers these two fundamental anchors, predictability and connection.
Yeah, it gives us moments of solid ground, moments of genuine community. It's an antidote.
So armed with this whole toolkit, ritualization, embodied knowledge, power dynamics, how can listeners, you know, actually use this in their lives?
Well, on a personal level, you can start by just noticing the ritual dimensions of your own routines.
My coffee making again.
Maybe. But more consciously, you could develop intentional personal rituals, a specific way to start the day, a moment for reflection, a journaling practice. Recognizing these aren't just habits, but small, structured ways to create stability and meaning for yourself, especially when things feel uncertain.
So acknowledge their ritual power, basically.
Yeah, and professionally. Think about workplace ritual.
Team meetings, company parties, onboarding new hires.
Exactly. Analyze them. How do they shape the culture? Who do they empower? How do they communicate the company's values or maybe contradict them? A manager who understands this can design, say, an onboarding process, not just as paperwork, but as a genuine rite of passage that helps new people feel truly part of the team.
Building that communitas we talked about.
Right. And then there's the critical application looking at public life.
Political rallies, sporting events.
Even online movements. Watch how they use symbols, flags, colors, logos. Notice the repetition slogans, chants, gestures. See how they orchestrate shared performance to create that collective effervescence, to build group identity and to mobilize people towards a goal. Use the lens of ritualization to understand how public meaning and power are being constructed.
It really changes how you watch the news, doesn't it?
It definitely can.
So wrapping this up, what's the single most important thing to take away from Stevenson's work?
I think it's a combination of intellectual humility and critical awareness. Humility because the concept of ritual is complex and maybe not what we thought. Awareness because the term itself has this loaded history we need to be mindful of.
So don't walk away with a simple definition of ritual.
No, walk away with better questions.
Right.
The real shift is thinking about process, about ritualization. How are actions being set apart? Why? By whom? What effects does that have?
It's moving from trying to define the essence of the thing to analyzing the strategy of how it's done.
That's the core move.
Okay, so here's a final thought for you, the listener, to chew on. If Stevenson is right, and modernity didn't get rid of ritual, but just kind of moved it around, maybe into more secular spaces, what's a highly secular activity in your own life?
Something maybe you don't think of as ritualistic at all.
Yeah. Could be checking social media feeds in a specific way, watching your favorite sports team with unwavering loyalty, even your fitness routine. Which of those functions most powerfully is a ritual for your sense of identity, your sense of belonging, your way of navigating the world? Something to think about. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.